You know, this is the best place in the world to speak. I said, especially at the end of the 3-month course. I figured you'd probably be interested in anything I have to say. but it's still a little nervous, you know, when you get started. And I drove here tonight with a friend who lives in Guatemala. And I realized the last time I had to talk to a group of people was in a village in Guatemala, and I had to speak in Spanish, and I'm just learning it. So I said to him, at least I don't have to do it in Spanish, you know. But I realized that it might be more appropriate because I only know the present tense. And so, since you are all being here now, I'll try not to lapse too much. But as Joseph was speaking, I was remembering when we did first meet. And I was thinking about it today because I was thinking about the first long sitting that I did. And although I know for some of you it's not your first long sitting, still, of course, every time is first in some way. But what a profound change it made in our lives. Certainly for me, it changed my life deeply and profoundly, and was one of the most important things that ever happened to me. And it made me feel, as I was coming here, you know, I just wanted to be here. I wanted to see everybody, even though we don't know each other personally. My son sat here at the young adults course this year. He's 17. And when he came back from it, he said, and he's always stayed, I wouldn't say he's in reaction, but he's stayed a little bit of distance, and we never pushed him to do practice or anything, hoping that it would come in its own time. And then when the course was offered, it was taught by Joseph and Sharon and Steve and others and Upandita. And it was that he was such a total presence that I almost forgot to mention him. He decided on the last day that somebody was driving, so he'd jump into the car. And then he got here, and it was very beautiful for him. And when he came home, he said, and Mom, I loved everybody there. And I said, oh yeah, it was so nice that some of your old friends were there and that you already knew some of the teachers and everything. And he said, no, Mom, you don't get it. I mean, everyone. So I just was reflecting on just, you know, the preciousness that we share together, having been that long and that deep inside yourself to the place where we really know that we are all the same. And I remembered that after when we met 20 years ago in India and we all sat together, and then after some years, kind of staggered over a little time, but basically during the same chapter, we all came back to the United States. And many of us who were in that kind of first team of people who were sitting in Bodh Gaya with the first teachers that we had found. People then looked to do all the many different kinds of things that we all do in the world. But there was a way in which, because we'd all discovered the Dharma together, you know, there was almost a kind of like a silent conspiracy in which we said, well, we've got to kind of cover all the different aspects of it now that we're back here, you know. And so it was almost as if, you know, Joseph and Sharon said, well, we're the good sitters, so we're going to teach meditation. You know, and I said, well, I think I'm going to try right livelihood, you know. And different people kind of took different pieces of this kind of dharmic pie, and of course, we all did the other parts as well, but so I spent a lot of time working in the world and being a parent, and most recently focusing on what we're calling compassionate action in the world. I've done this now for 3 years, and I always, you know, feel like I kind of get brought in as a kind of a real person who's actually out in the world who can tell you that it's all right out there, you know, it's okay to go back out. I think I'll look at my notes. I don't want to, is this? Oh, okay. I was thinking about the double experience of how when you leave here, in one way, it is continuity with exactly what's happening here, that the unfolding of life and the mind is just all of one piece. And of course, it's not any different in that level. When you go back to people you knew before, or new people, and work, and life outside the meditation hall. And then, of course, it's different in that you've been away from certain kinds of stimulation for a long time, and there's a wondrous new quality about seeing things again. I remembered driving here that after doing this first long sit I did in India. Before that, I had been in India only a week when I heard about this meditation course that was being taught. And I heard about it by meeting Sharon on the street in Delhi. We had been at the same university here, and we hadn't known each other. And we met on the street in New Delhi. And Sharon said, there's a meditation course being taught in Bodh Gaya for Westerners. And I remember thinking, well, wow, meditation. I'm in India, I guess, you know, I had never sat down and crossed my legs and closed my eyes, you know. And then, so I went and we became, we didn't call it roommates then because we all lived in one big room like this, all the women. And we were separated by saris. We hung up our saris and they sort of were very filmy. It was more like a seraglio than a monastery, you know. And we were there, but Sharon and I were behind one sari together. And we sat. But so I had just had a week in India before I started sitting. And during that week, I had visited the Taj Mahal. And I had just traveled all through Europe and overland through those mysterious places that are no longer available to us, like Afghanistan and Iran. And I had gone to the Taj Mahal, and I had been to so many kind of extraordinary architectural sites on the way that when I got to the Taj Mahal, it was a quite beautiful building. But that was really all. And then I sat for those months, and then I went back to the Taj Mahal, and I remember that. In those days, of course, we all wore long, white, flowing costumes, you know. And I remember that we danced on the marble. There's this marble all around the outside of it. And we danced in these long, white clothes on the floor of the Taj Mahal, and it was like, you know, it was heaven. It was so extraordinary, you know. It was just white and gleaming, and everything shone, and I went back to it later, and somehow it had changed again, but there will be some wonderful moments, you know, of sort of this wonderful heightened visions of things. And mixed with difficulty of adjusting to the vibrational levels that you'll find so many people operating on, like me, you know, out there. It's hard to stay quiet and slow. It's very hard. And patience. Patience will be good. Patience will be useful. Will be. Don't forget, I told you that. And I think the biggest difference between being in here, sitting, and being inside the monastery, and whenever you do, you know, short retreats in your home or whatever, and being engaged in the world, that it involves relationships with people and with work and with people you don't know. It's, of course, you're connected to it all by sitting here, and sometimes more powerfully, of course, because you're more open and more tuned than you are at other times. But there's a difference when you have to get out there and interrelate with other people and work and so on. And I think the key to that, well, what's so wonderful is, as I thought through that re-entry process, is that through the practice just sitting here, and this is going to sound very obvious, but just sitting here and watching your mind, you have everything you need to be in the world in exactly the way you always wanted to be. Because, of course, the center of being harmonious in relationship to it all is insight and compassion. And now, there's a way, I don't think any of us think that there hasn't been plenty of suffering through the many centuries that people been on the planet, but there has been, in the immediate and obvious sense, a real, for us, in terms of immediate perception in the worlds that we live in out there, there's definitely been an increase in obvious suffering in our worlds in the last 8 or 9 years in this country, and that as you re-enter the world with more openness, it's going to be more obvious to you than ever. And you'll find that you are drawn back to your awareness of your connection with all other beings. And unless you do some very heavy blocking as soon as you encounter it, you're going to experience sadness and suffering yourself in seeing the suffering that other people are experiencing. There are some ways that work better than other ways for being with that in the world. I have recently been working on a book with Ram Dass, who probably many of you know. It's a book on compassionate action. He wrote a book a few years ago called How Can I Help? And it's about these very things. Now we're putting together what we call a companion to it that will focus on how to get involved in compassionate action or service when you're awakened to the suffering around you and you experience a compassionate response. And in the process of working on that, I have been trying to bring my mind, as well as my non-mind of experiencing compassion into the whole, into that realm. And as you know better than almost anyone right now, that those, the deep, profound states can't be spoken. And I've seen how true that is because I keep poking around and researching and looking for the definitive statement on compassion. And at first, you know, I just said, why hasn't anybody said it yet? And it took me quite a while to realize that, it must be because it can't be said. But I wanted to read you a few words from other people on compassion to give you a sense of, you know, when you approach something from many different directions, sometimes like a jewel, you get those different aspects of it play back on each other and give you some sense of the whole. Now this description you may have read just this week, but you'll love it anyhow. It's from Sharon. It's from the calendar. The Buddha described compassion, and I love this, as a trembling or quivering of the heart in response to pain, our own or another's. It's a very tender state, a very open state. Compassion means that we can be present with what is happening. We can accept it and move to offer help without anger, ill will, or grief. The subtle enemy of compassion is aversion. It defines the pain as unbearable. You know, there's a point where, you know, you have to act on it. Unbearable. You can't bear it anymore, so you have to act. That's the point after which it gets hard to figure out what to do. That's sort of what I'm really looking at right now. But there is that moment, the pain is unbearable, and it says, I can't stand feeling this or watching someone else feel it. Compassion as trembling of the heart is a state of strongly trusting in ourselves, knowing we can bear witness to the pain, knowing that we can face it directly without having to pretend or make it go away. I brought some copies of this. This is a Seva newsletter we just published, and it has a piece by Ram Dass on compassion in it that he calls the delicate balance. The balance between seeing suffering in the world and knowing that there's a wrongness about it, I mean feeling that there's a wrongness and it should be changed, or an unfairness, or those kinds of social feelings one has. And then knowing at the same time that everything is unfolding exactly as it should. So being able to love and embrace and accept exactly what's happening. And then out of that double awareness, being able to act for change the way you see it. There are a few lines here that I thought were good. It's all good, but there's a few lines I thought you might like. Where do we begin this amazing journey to our center point of balance? We begin right where we are. We look around and find a way to engage our hearts and hands with the suffering in the world around us. And at the same moment, we set about cultivating a more reflective state of mind through giving ourselves quiet moments for meditation, for study, for contemplation. These are the ingredients we put into the pot, and then we stir. Now here are some other favorite people of yours, I'm sure. Thomas Merton said, the whole idea of compassion is based on a keen awareness of the interdependence of all these living beings, which are all part of one another and all involved in one another. That was the last talk he gave 2 hours before he died. He said that. Mother Teresa says, God loves to work through us, you and me. The way you touch people, the way you give to people, that love for one another It's His love in action through us. Real calm. Oh, that my priest's robes were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. Lao Tzu, having bestowed all he has on others, he has yet more. Having given all he has to others, he is richer still. Here's an African proverb. Love is like the misty rain that falls softly but floods the river. Eckhart said, the world is dying for lack of compassion. Lama Govinda said, compassion is the spontaneous urge to help others, flowing from the knowledge of oneness. Matthew Fox, he's a Christian philosopher, said, compassion is not altruism in the sense of loving others who are different from ourselves. It's loving ourselves while we love others. And so on. So what I've been finding in interviewing people for this book is that the people who are most effective in the world are the people who are most kind of awakened in their center of compassion. And it comes out in so many different ways. I had a great interview with a woman, some of you may know, in the Bay Area. Her name is Fran Peavy. She's a peace activist, and she's also a stand-up comedian. I loved this. I was thinking today that the wonderful thing about clarity and awareness is that one sees several levels at once, and of course that's what humor is about. I said to her, well, what do you do when you're a stand-up comedian? Because she looks like a Buddhist nun. She said, I read the newspaper out loud. It's good. So, but she, this was interesting to me. She had been a civil rights worker, and she'd done a number of other things in the Bay Area. Actually, she's working on, one of the themes that we work with is people often think that certain areas of suffering are too big to meddle in because they're overwhelming. So if I start trying to relate to that, it's just going to be too big for me to even make any difference at all. One of the projects she's working on is cleaning up the Ganges River. I said, whoa, that's good. But anyhow, she had been working on things that were close to home. And some friends of hers wanted her to be involved in the anti-nuclear global movement, and she felt very drawn to it. But she said, I can't do it, because the way that I draw energy for my work is that I sit every morning, and at the end of my meditation, I bring into my awareness those people who I will be serving during this day of what I do. And she said, I haven't been in other parts of the world, and I don't know anybody there, and I think that my work will have a quality of thinness to it. So, this is not true for everyone, of course. I mean, many of us can bring that kind of the 10,000 beings, into awareness in different ways. But for her, it needed to be very personal. And so she sold, I think, everything she owned. When I met her, she owned very little. And she went around the world. I don't know if it was the whole world, but she went to some other countries, a number of other countries. And she took with her, in each place, I guess, she made a sign. She went into parks And she sat down and she made a sign, and it said, in whatever language, American willing to listen. And people came up to her and talked to her, and she met people. And then she came back home. And she said when she came home, she was, you know when you get into those spaces where something like that, from the place you can get to in meditation, I mean, it sounds perfectly reasonable, you know? And you know the place you can get to when you meet people you've never seen before in strange places and you're absolutely intimate. But then you get back into American culture, you know, and she said she felt totally weird about it. And she was embarrassed to tell anybody that she'd done this. So she didn't for a long time until she told a close friend of hers one day. And that, she was speaking that night, Fran was, and about something, and the friend was introducing her. And the friend told the group that Fran had done this thing. And she received a standing ovation, and then she knew it was okay. But anyhow, she then said that she then came back to the United States, and then every morning she would bring these people that she met all around the world into her heart and mind and awareness. That was the story I heard that was kind of closest and kind of most graphic and real to what we know here as to the practice it's done here. But for instance, black women I talked to most frequently, of course, had a Christian connection. And just had an open channel somehow to, they just got the glimpse that we are all connected and that we're all here for each other. And they just kept renewing that and doing unbelievable things. Once that energy is liberated, this one woman, also in the Bay Area, in Oakland, she had brought up 12 children of her own as a single parent. And well, she obviously wasn't single the whole time, but on and off. And she then, when the children were grown up, she just, several people have told me that in the middle of the night, they knew what they should do. And she said that. And what she should do was start feeding people. And she started cooking and feeding the homeless in Oakland. And she now, and I was in her home, she now cooks in her kitchen. This is a small working class house in Oakland with a kitchen that's not big enough to have a kitchen table in. She cooks for 500 to 700 people. I mean, as we used to say in India, full khana, like everything, you know? Fried chicken, she's from Louisiana. Fried chicken, and I shouldn't say that, I suppose. And it's like, I used to go to OA meetings, and you were never allowed to say the words for food, you know? But fried chicken and, you know, greens and breads. And she takes them to the park, and she feeds all these people every week. I mean, she's 70. The energy that's, you know, and the energy to... One of my questions when I started out for people who was, because I know that lots of us have this problem of what's called in the helping professions, burnout, was, you know, how do you keep from burning out, or what do you do when you burn out? Most of the really good ones I talked to looked at me like I had said it in a foreign language. They just, it wasn't not an issue. That once, not once, but in as much as we continue to renew our connection to the truth that we are all connected and that we are all here for each other, and every one of us is is connected in that way that you know when you get as deep as you can in your practice and you see what you see in yourself and you know that it's universal. Understanding, when you take it out into the world, nourishes and feeds and allows you to do things that that you want to do in that moment that Sharon described as unbearable, you know. Some other things that may be little guides for in life that many people told me was, this is a very Zen direction, is to start right where you are. Of course, you've been, I'm sure, it's not like it's not been happening to you even here where you're focused inward, but to start small and to start right where you are, and that some people call it like the kitchen table school of compassionate action and philanthropy. Of one woman told me about she back in the 50s, her husband was a doctor, and she discovered, they started discovering that they were doing nuclear, maybe it was atomic testing then, in the atmosphere. And she knew about it. There was strontium 90, do you remember that? That was a long time ago. in the environment, and it got into the milk. And she had little children, and so she started buying up powdered milk that was powdered before this got into the environment. And then she bought it for her, bought it up for her children. And then she thought, I'll buy some for my friends' children too. And then she was buying more milk and more milk, and she was hoarding all this milk that from before the strontium 90. And she said, and then one day I realized I couldn't buy enough milk for every mother who had children. And she then started, what she did was she said, in those days she said, you know, we gave teas and we invited each other to things by writing on little engraved notes. So I wrote to all my friends on little engraved notes and asked them to come and join me for a talk. And they came and we talked about strontium 90, and they began what was the beginning of, it was really the beginning in Western Massachusetts, it was the beginning of the whole freeze movement. But that was right, it came right from her most immediate concerns as a mother, her own children. It began small, just the way, just at home. So, I don't want to get too into all this since you've been away from work in the world for such a long time, but I just guess the thing that I've been aware of most in all the different kinds of work we've been trying to do is that the most important element in all of compassionate action and any kind of work in the world is listening, and listening for what's needed. And of course, you all are so tuned right now that you'll be able to hear. You'll be able to hear from other people, and you'll be able to hear from situations what's needed in that situation. And after that, you know, the only thing is to carefully look inside yourselves for what it is that you can bring to the situation. And then unfolds a partnership between you and whoever is asking for help, and together you can work to make change. It's really easy. I think often of a kind of motto from, it's from the world of Aikido that I used to do, which is expect nothing, but be prepared for anything. The last thing I wanted to share was, this is something I've always felt, and I've started hearing it from a lot of other people I've been talking to, and that is the awareness of the earth, which is what we're all part of, and the main thing that you're going to be relating to, but the earth as the mother. And you know, the great bodhisattva of compassion is Kuan Yin, which is a manifestation of the loving mother. And I had two poems here about the earth as a mother, in the sense that if you listen to her, she'll guide you. You'll know exactly what to do, how to do it. The two nice ones. Now you have to hear this, the mythological level, because this one, they lean a little bit out of Buddhism here. So. But they're good. This one's by Diane de Prima, who's been actually very connected with Buddhist teachers and teachings. And this is the end of a poem that she wrote called Ave, about the mother as the earth. I walk the long night seeking you. I climb the sea crest seeking you. I lie on the prairie, batter at stone gates, calling your names. You are coral. You are lapis and turquoise. Your brain curls like shell. You dance on hills. Hard substance woman, you whirl. You dance on subways. You sprawl in tenements. Children lick at your breasts. You are the hills, the shape and color of mesa. You are the tent, the lodge of skins, the hogan, the buffalo robes, the quilt, the knitted afghan. You are the cauldron and the evening star. You rise over the sea. You ride the dark. I move within you. Light the evening fire. I dip my hand in you and eat your flesh. You are my mirror image and my sister. You disappear like smoke on misty hills. You lead me through dream forest on horseback. Large gypsy mother, I lean my head on your back. I am you, and I must become you. I have been you, and I must become you. I am always you. I must become you. Maya ma. Maya ma. Om star mother ma. Om Maya ma. And this one by a poet named Joy Harjo is called Remember. Both these poems have the, you know, the richness and complexity of what you're about to enter. Remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon, know who she is. I met her in a bar once in Iowa City. Remember the sun's birth at dawn. That is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away to night. Remember your birth, how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father, his hands cradling your mother's flesh and maybe her heart too, and maybe not. He is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are, red earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth, black earth, we are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them, listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind, remember her voice. She knows the origin of this universe. I heard her singing Kiowa war dance songs at the corner of 4th and Central once. Remember, you are all people, and that all people are you. Remember that you are this universe, and that this universe is you. Remember that all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember that language comes from this. Remember the dance that language is, that life is. Remember to remember. we have some time left if you'd like to talk about anything. We could do it. Or if you want to ask questions of any kind. Oh, I can't see that far. Yeah?
What do you do with the Guatemalan diligence?
We work to give support to people there as they try to develop and improve their agriculture, their health, sometimes their livelihood, sometimes education, training, all the different aspects of life there. We try to give support in the ways that is asked for in each place. I know it sounds a little vague, but it's different in each situation. We work with Mayan Indian called campesinos, or farmers, in Guatemala, who don't have enough land, essentially, to feed their families. So we try to help them find new ways to live better with what they've got. Is that the level you wanted? Okay. That's part of what's really started awakening this real sense of the earth as mother in me. It's very interesting. They're very deeply spiritual people. And when the Spanish came to Guatemala, they introduced, shall we say, Catholicism. It wasn't really a choice for anybody. And but the Mayans were able to integrate their own religion, or spirits, really more spirituality, there, which is very much focused on the earth as mother. And what they did was they kind of took on God the Father from Christianity and kind of married the two. And, I mean, at times they'll say, you know, that they're very comfortable with that. And it's very interesting because it's not this simple, and this is kind of a romantic description of it, but to some extent, it's what allowed them to keep their original Mayan spirituality growing, because they were able to do the two. So, just interesting. They do their what in India are called pujas, you know, little ceremonies, customs, sometimes right inside the Christian cathedrals, bring the two together. Their chanting is sometimes, to me, sounds almost identical to Tibetan Buddhist chanting. So interesting. Yeah?
If you wanted to do some volunteer work through Seva, how could you do that?
You should probably get in touch with me after, you know, and I mean, after you leave here. It's tricky with Seva. Most of our work is out of this country. And because of our respect for the people in other places, we're trying to work as much as we can by giving support to indigenous people wherever they are, rather than in the colonial tradition bring us in to fix things, you know. So that makes it hard, however, because we all want to help. So this is one of the reasons that Ram Dass and I are working on this book, because so often people ask, how can I help? Sometimes, however, there are things. I mean, you should, you know, we have some things, and you should get in touch with me later. I have an office in Cambridge, and just call. But and also, I brought some copies of the Seva newsletter, which has the article on compassion by Ram Dass. I'll put them in the office before I go, so the number's in there. But it's a kind of, I mean, we're always trying to encourage everybody to do this sort of thing, you know, but we don't have so many. The real answer is you have to look inside to find out what it is, and then open your eyes and look outside and find the match, you know. And sometimes Seva has it, but sometimes he doesn't. Yes?
As far as the situation in Nepal,
mm-hmm.
my father worked here as an ophthalmologist at Seva.
Uh-huh.
And I am curious now, not knowing the late, very latest situation, if I know that they've been really training the Nepalese mm-hmm. to actually do the surgery. What's the status on it now? Have they really gotten it so that they're all Nepalese doctors that have been trained up?
We're on a 5-year plan now that's moving toward, it's not clear whether the country has the financial resources to ever be completely self-reliant in that realm, but in terms of other resources, in 5 years, it'll be entirely Nepalese. And now, I mean, we still have some ophthalmologists from here who go, but mainly they're the ones who've sort of gone from the beginning and have so many friends there and are so much part of it that it's not like sending in a new person, kind of. Yeah, since the bit, I mean, so the program's 10 years old now, and there's so many ophthalmologists. When we started there, I remember that there were more ophthalmologists in Berkeley, California, than there were in the whole country of Nepal. I don't remember, that was 10 or something, you know. Now, there are about enough to serve at least as far as the program has evolved. That first, we're building a hospital this year, and it's the site of, and the way we've been working on it, we, Seva and the Nepalis and others all together, is to create one zone in Nepal and in the Terai, and then that will be duplicated in other parts of the country, the whole way of dealing with blindness there. And the place that we're starting is Lumbini, which you probably all know. It's the birthplace of the Buddha. And we're building our first hospital there this year. It's nice. Yes?
Often be back at work with people who are in a lot of mental and physical suffering, and I'm very open right now. I'd love to hear some words of advice on not shutting down, not letting it stick.
I think maintaining your practice will be the most important thing. Isn't that right?
No.
No, I mean, it's the most effective thing you can do. Everybody knows that who does it and who does that kind of work. I mean, you know, there's no question about it. You'll see. I mean, it works here, but it really works for. You'll be very happy that you know how to sit. Because it's just a matter of not getting attached to the suffering of other people, or you can't serve it well. And that also is the greatest gift. Not only will that help you to keep going, but it's such a great gift to other people, you know. You know when you've been with people who are suffering, and you can maintain that double awareness where you can see their suffering, and it's not that you don't care, but at the same time, you're not really caught in it, you know. It's such a great gift, you know. So, and what'll happen is, at first, you'll be very open and you'll see the way in which you're able to serve that way, that your openness around it changes the relationship between you. And you'll be motivated to keep it open, you will be, and the best way to do it is to sit, you know. And there'll be times when it gets awful, you know, but it's just to, you know, keep on going and just don't get discouraged, you know, just keep sitting. And I mean, there are lots of other tips, but that's really the most important thing. It's great. good luck. Joachim Trumpo always used to say, people, I'm sure you remember, they'd come to him and they'd pour their whole life out for him, you know. He'd say, good luck. I always love that. Yes.
I know the difference intuitively when someone's really supporting me and when someone's really averse to it. And the people who bring fear to my suffering actually add to it, and I want to say go away, you know. And I guess I want to ask you, the people that you've helped, whether they have given you feedback, or do you sense
that? Well, I think you know the other side too, because it's always going back and forth all the time, you know, that you also know. I can't think of, you know, testimonials or anything, but I can think of that, you know, vibrationally, you know, when that's going on, it's just as compassion is spontaneously arising, appreciation spontaneously arises, and when you're open, you know, you know it. And that's what keeps you going, because you know it's kind of like biofeedback, you know. You feel right, and as long as, of course, we know sometimes things feel right and they're wrong, but but I mean, as long as you keep trying as close to the truth as possible, you can go forward on that, right? Does that help? Not really. Yeah. I think it's always good to tell people who are helping you that they're helping you, you know? I was giving you examples of the people who kind of never burn out, but of course, I know. I teach a lot of workshops with Ram Dass, and some of you may have been at some of them, but a lot of the kinds of people who come are people in the, you know, helping professions. And, you know, it's a big problem. And one of the big problems for people is that they don't get thanked, or they don't get, doesn't get turned around, you know, and they aren't able to always be free from attachment to wanting some feedback, you know. So it's a good thing to do always. Mother Wright, who I was talking about, the Clorox Corporation, God knows where they came from, but they awarded her a van to take her food from her house to the park, and in a big ceremony, and on the outside of the van they had painted Angel of the Poor. She really liked that. So yeah. Yes. Get her name right. I've lost her. Joy Harjo. Harjo. It's a very nice book called She Rises Like the Sun. It's an anthology. Yes? Oh, I can't see you too well, but.
Mm-hmm.